Okay, good morning. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for coming. It's great to see everybody. Hope everybody's well. Their families are well. So we have the second part of our two-part series today. And next week, please God, I want to move on to Pastors New. We talked a lot about Israel and Eretz Israel, and we'll talk a bit more today. But next week, I want to get into the very controversial question of Geirut. Conversion, where does it come from, how does it work, why is there a controversy about it, and we've never spoken about Geirut before, and I look forward to that opportunity with you. Today, the Shirim, for the whole year, but including today, continue to be sponsored by our anonymous donor, who is sponsored in the merit of Aliyah for the Neshamas of Matasyahu Ben Yisrael, Aaron Ben Menachem Lev, and Eliana Bas Yaakov. We're grateful for the sponsorship to be in Aliyah for their Neshamas. If I could remind you, the new sponsorship system is that this kind sponsor has sponsored the Zoom Shirim for the whole of 2021, but the on-site Shirim are still open for sponsorship if anybody's interested in sponsoring a Shir for a special occasion or in memory of somebody, then we will be happy to receive that. Fine. Next week, a little bit of housekeeping. There is a special morning of learning next week for pre-Rosh Chodesh, for the women's learning shiur for the whole morning. So I'd encourage you, if you're a woman and you want to learn about these issues next week, then that will be here. Our shiur will be upstairs. I suspect the 9:15 Rabbi Nadel shiur also will be upstairs, so you'll have to go up a few flights, but if you want to come to the women's learning morning, then that will be here, and you will be more than welcome. Fine. If I could just remind you, please, to turn your phones off, so that everybody can get through the shiur without accompaniment. Now, what did we do last week? Last week, I must tell you, I got a little bit of email correspondence from the shiur last week. That's not such a terrible thing, but I'll come on to that in a moment. Let's recap what we did last week. Last week, we spoke about a few things. Number one, we looked at some of the key sources on the very special nature of Eretz Israel in our minds, in our hearts. No surprises there, but we put a few of those together. We also looked at two very important halachic inyanim. One is the mitzvah of living in the land, and we said that there is apparently a machloket between the Ramban, Nachmanides, and the Rambam, Maimonides, on whether this is or is not an obligation today. It's not so straightforward, and we talked about the complications last week. The Ramban apparently clearly says that it is a mitzvah to conquer the land, to dwell in the land, in all generations, even if there's no Mashiach, etc. That seems to be a fairly clear mitzvah, although we saw Rabbi Bleich said no, the mitzvah on the klal to conquer the land is not, even according to the Ramban, is not effective today, only a mitzvah on the individual to live in Eretz Israel. Okay, so we saw it's not so straightforward. And as for the Ramban, Maimonides, why he didn't include this as one of the mitzvahs in the list, we talked about lots of different approaches. But apparently there is a machloki between the Ramban, who says that we have to take the land and we may not give it away, to the Rambam, who is less clear in his opinion. We also then looked at a very important Minchat Chinuch. The Minchat Chinuch asked the question, well, even according to the Ramban, why isn't Pikuach Nefesh an overriding factor? Surely, even if we have a mitzvah to live in the land, that doesn't override, but one of the big three, it's not murder, avodah zarah, or immorality, so surely Pikuach Nefesh should be an exception to this mitzvah. And the Minchas Chinuch said no, because you, by definition, this mitzvah to conquer the land involves fighting a war. And you cannot fight a war without endangering your life. So in this particular case, there is no exception of Pikuach Nefesh. Other people disagreed. Rav Soloveitchik disagreed. Other people disagreed. So those two factors, which are, do we follow the Ramban? And do we follow the position of the Minchas Chinuch, which is that danger to life is not relevant in this mitzvah? That really is the crux, if you like, of this debate. And something I didn't mention last week, which I will start with, two preliminary comments. Rav Amital raised the question. He said, okay, you feel very strongly that the mitzvah follows the Ramban, that Nachmanides is the mitzvah. I think somebody's phone's trying to direct them to get to on Waze or something. If there's nowhere nice to go, we're happy to go, but there are other ways to get there today. Rav Amital made an important point, which is, are you sure that we pass in like the Ramban? Meaning you wish to risk people's lives, because you feel very strongly that the halacha is like the Ramban, not the Rambam, and like the Minchas Chinuch, not, are you sure? Can you be 100% positive? Is this something you're prepared to risk people's lives over when there is clearly a debate on the matter? Rav Amital raises an important point. We'll come back to Rav Amital today as well. And finally, I just want to make a point to kick up on last week. Somebody wrote to me and said to me, very nice, polite letter, that suggested I might have been a bit on the strong side when I said that if I upset anyone in America, making them feel uncomfortable or wherever they are, that there is a mitzvah to make aliyah, then I said I'm not apologetic for that because the person should be a little bit uncomfortable about that. So he wrote me a very polite letter, which I responded to hopefully politely as well. And I think based on his comments, which are very welcome, I would clarify one point, which I actually did mention last week, which is we are talking here about the klali mitzvah, the mitzvah of klali Yisrael, to take Eretz Yisrael, to live in Eretz Yisrael. And quite frankly, having gavened for that for 2,000 years, and now having the ability to do it, the fact that millions of people choose not to do it should, I think, make us feel a little uncomfortable on a global level. However, I did make clear last week that the individual decision as to whether or not to make Aliyah is a separate matter, which we talked about in previous shiurim. And my position on this has always been consistent, and we got this position from Rabbi Kimchi, who is very much my rav in many matters, and certainly on this matter, is that not everybody has to move to Eretz Yisrael tomorrow morning. It's not, there are halachic heterim, there are hashkafic reasons, there are all sorts of reasons that plug into that personal cheshbon, but everybody has to have it on their agenda, as a serious agenda item. Meaning, if you're living in Chutz La'aretz, and you're not a sat mechosid. Because if you're a sat mechosid, then fine, I have no tainas against anybody. Because then you should not be coming to live in Israel because it's a consistent... But if you're not a sat mechosid, and you don't wish to pretend to be a sat mechosid, then coming to live in Israel has to be an agenda item. Our Rav always said to us, sit down once a year, have a little annual general meeting, the two of you, I did that with my wife, we went through all the cheshbonot. The money, the parents, the children, the job, the chinuch, everything. We went through the list, should we or shouldn't we? And that's what he told us to do every year. Seriously. The truth is that every year that came out to the answer, no, we should stay in London. And then we went on. One year we went out for dinner and we did all those cheshbonot and it came out the answer was, yes, we should move to Israel. And we said to each other, that can't be right. It always comes out no. Let's do those numbers again. And we did it again and it came out yes. Oh, okay, fine. So that is definitely something to be considered on an individual basis in consultation with your rabbonim and mentors, etc. But it should always be an agenda item. Fine. Let's move on to today's share. We've got a lot to do today, and in case you feel a little bit pessimistic about us getting through 12 sheets or 13, don't worry, we won't do all of them. But I like to give you some homework, something to read at home between one share and the next. Let's have a look today in two parts. So let's look at some historical precedents. Is there anything we can look back on the issue of land for peace, that we can see that any guidance comes from Chazal, number one, even that the situation is never going to be quite like the one we have today. No two situations are exactly the same. And let's have a look at some modern voices over the last 60 years on the issue of land for peace and see if they can apply in any way on the situation that we find ourselves in today. Number one, let's start with some parshanut, which is not normal for this shiur, but it's very much necessary here. Number one, Vahi acharat dvarim ha'ela. This is the Akedah, and the Akedah is coming up, and the Rashbam jumps in and has a very lengthy comment on the Akedah as follows. He says as follows. Kol makam shenema achar dvarim ha'ele. Whenever you see in the Chumash that it says after these things, mechubar ala parshish milamala. He gives you a cloud. Every time you see it says the word after these things, there is a link between them. Obviously, that's on a pshat level. After these things, then this thing happens. And he gives some examples. Achar dvarim ha'ele, shahar gavram et ha'malachim, after Abraham killed the four kings. Amaloya kodesh baruch hu, Hashem says to him, al tira Abraham, don't be afraid. Link between the two things. Minalmus of the nations around you. Vayihi achar dvarim ha'ele, and then after the Akedah itself, shenolad Yitzhak, Yitzhak been born, vayugila Avram la'alom le'mor, Avram was told, what was he told? Ubesul yaladid Rivka, that there's a little girl, a cousin that can marry Yitzhak. Good. Vachein achar dvarim ha'ele, so too in the Megillah, shehigid Mordechai al Bigtan v'Teresh, that Mordechai told Achashverosh about the plot of Bigtan and Teresh. Then, Gadol HaMalach HaShverosh et Haman. Haman was then raised straight after this. Shirata Harag es Mordechai, and he wanted to kill Mordechai, V'hoylo Moshe Hitzel et HaMelech V'nitla Haman. And because of the reporting of Bichan and Peresh, that's what eventually saved Mordechai, killed Haman, etc. Now, he comes to his main point. Afkan, here too, at the beginning of the Akedah, Acha Hadvarim, after these matters, Shekaras Avram Brisla Avimelech. Okay, Avram had just entered into a partnership, a brit, a covenant with Avimelech. Okay, Lot, with him, Ula Ninav, and with his children, Ula Nechtav, and with his grandchildren, Shel Avraham. He bound his descendants. For Natan Lo Sheva Kvasot Hatzon, and he gave him seven sheep. This is one of the origins of Be'er Sheva. There are many, many ways that Be'er Sheva is described as being called Be'er Sheva. So he gave him these seven sheep. V'chara Afra Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, the Rashram Hashem became very angry. Alzot, at this point, Shehari Eretz Plishtim Bechal Gvul Yisrael, because this land of the Plishtim that Avram Avinu had just made a treaty and given away, I won't bother you, I won't invade your land, is part of Eretz Yisrael. V'HaKadosh Baruch Hu Tziva, and God commanded Aleim on these, or he will command, and Avram, in a sense, knew this or connected with this. We had a whole shiur about whether the Avot kept the Torah and how, not for now. Lot chiyeh kol neshama. He's not allowed to let these people live. He can't do a treaty with the seven nations. V'gam b'Yoshua matilin al arech hameshes sarani plishtim, and even in the time of Yoshua in chapter 13 there, that he makes a goral on the land of the plishtim. So Avram shouldn't have done this. Ulachain, and therefore v'helokim nisa et Avram. Because of Avram entering into this treaty with the local nations, that's why God came now to test Abraham. King Tarah, he tested him, he tried him, he irritated him, and he hurt him. Kalam, as if to say, Nitgaeta baben shenatativ, you've now become so proud of the son that I gave you. Lichrot brit beinechem ubein beinechem, to make a treaty from between your children and their children. You're so confident now in your children. Take him and offer him up as a korban. You've been overconfident. You've been over arrogant with your children. You've been banking on having something that you cannot bank on. And you'll see what will become of your treaty. There will be no treaty. There will be no children. And then the Rashbam, quite uncharacteristically, starts quoting Midrashim. He does this in a few places, but here he brings a number of Midrashim, says you can back this up with Midrashim. Ve'i Aaron Hashem be'eretz plishtim shiva chadashim. In Sefer Shoftim, at the beginning of Shmuel, when the Aaron HaBrit is taken for 7 months in the land of the Plishtim, the Midrash says, you gave him seven sheep. There will be seven wars that these people fight against you and win. His children, the Plishtim, will kill seven of your great people, the Eluheim, and here they are, Shimshon, Chofni, Finchas, Shaul, the Shloshes Banav, and the three sons of Shaul. Alternatively, because of these seven sheep that you gave him, seven of your temples will be destroyed, the Eluheim, or Hilmoyet, the Gilgal, Noiv, Shiloh, Givon, and Beit Olamim, and two temples. Davar Acher, another midrash. She'aron Machzir B'Sadeh Plishtim, the Aaron will be in the fields of the Plishtim, Sheva Chadashim. And therefore, he says, Nisa, God wanted to test Abraham. His translation is, Contrariel, which is, I'm not good on old French, but here he says, it's not like a test. Let's see how strong Abraham is. It's a response. I go against you, I oppose you, I frustrate you and impede you in what you're trying to do with your children. Interesting. So okay, that's Pashanut, it's not Halakha. But it's a very interesting example, the Rashbam saying, living in France in medieval times, if we ever were strong enough to think that we should make a brit with the people around us and it'll be good for us, it's not good for us. It's a bad precedent. That's clearly the case. So as far as the Rashbam understands it, with the Akedah. Again, Parashanut, can you pass in Halacha based on it? No, but it's interesting hashgafically. Secondly, a situation which is less well known. Here, look in Malachim. So Shlomo HaMelech has built the temple, and he's had a lot of partnership with Hiram, the king of Tsur, which is in now Lebanon, just above the border with Eretz Israel, or maybe even within the border of Eretz Israel. Vahim Miktat Esrim Shana, 20 years have gone by, Ashabana Shlomo et Shnei Habatim, he's built these two wonderful palaces, at Beit Hashem, the Eitz Beit HaMelech, the king's palace, the royal palace, and the temple. Chiram, Melach Tzor, Nisa et Shlomo, Va'atze Arazim, and Chiram had provided him with wood, Va'atze Broshim, and with cedar, with cypress, with sand, with gold, Kol Chatzor, as Yitin HaMelech Shlomo, Chiram, Esrim Ir Be'eretz HaGalil. So King Shlomo decides, well, what the least I can do is give you 20 cities in the Galil. Oh, interesting. Land for, it's not land for peace, but it's land for thanks. Thank you for the gold. Here's 20 cities in Israel. It didn't work out as well as Shlomo planned. So he thinks, thank you very much. Let's come and see these cities. He came down to see these cities in the Galil, which had been given to him by Shlomo. The Layash remained. And he was very unhappy. This is what you've given me. Vayomer, and he said, Ma'arim ha'ele asher natata li achi. It sounds very Israeli, Torah, at this point. I mean, normally people can say achi to Shlomo HaMelech. He says, what's this you've given me? Vayikra lahem Eretz Kabul. And he called it Eretz Kabul. Now, this could be actually up near Akko. If you go just south and just east of Akko, there is an Arab village called Kabul, which could be the site of the ancient town of Kabul, mentioned here and also mentioned in Yoshua. Well, he wasn't happy with that. I said, sorry, Ada Yom Hazeh. It's called Kabul to this day. However, if you go over the page, if you look at number 3, you'll see an interesting contrary account. In Divrei Hayamim, number 3, in Divrei Hayamim it says, Vayihi miketz esrim shana shebana shloma et beit Hashem ve'et beito. Same idea, 20 years after he's finished all the building. It's not that Shlomo gave him 20 cities, but the king of Tzur gave Shlomo 20 cities, the other way around. Okay? The Shlomo, Bana Shlomo Otam, and Shlomo built those cities for Yosef Shameh Bnei Israel, and he settled the Jewish people there. So how do you put these two accounts together? So you can look in the Malbim in your own time. The Malbim says they go together. What happened is that Shlomo HaMelech gave a gift of these 20 cities to Shlomo, to Hiram. And he looked at them and he said, Epis, this is a gift. You can take this back. I'm not taking these. Nothing grows there. Eretz Kabul, he says, it's like sand dunes. There's nothing growing there. I can't make anything of these cities. So he gave them back to Shlomo. And Shlomo said, okay, you can't make anything of them. But when I settle the Jews in these places, they're going to flourish. Don't you worry. And he built those 20 cities and they turned into very, very wealthy cities. And he gave from the money that he raised from them to Hiram, which is very interesting. There's a lot of ideas within here. First of all, the idea he should not have tried to give them away in the first place. Second of all, if Jews give land to non-Jews in Eretz Israel, even if it was the most fertile land, nothing will come of it. And it just turns back into sand dunes. You can go down south, you can go to Sderot, you can look over at the beautiful areas that used to be beautiful, where Gush Katif had all their greenhouses and etc. And you can see they are now what they were before 1967, sand dunes. And that's in Malachim, and that is also in Divrei Hayamim. Interesting. A third example, Chizkiyahu, number 5, Tana Rabbanan. Shisha dvarim asa Chizkiyahu HaMelech did 6 things. Ashlosha hodoloi, quite a famous Mishnah in Pesachim. 3 things the rabbis agreed with, 3 things the rabbis disagreed with. So one of the things the rabbis disagreed with was the tunnels, with the water and everything, but that's not for now. So one of the things the rabbis disagreed with, Kitzeis delaso shel heichal v'shigran ha-melech Ashur. He cut off the gold from the doors of the heichal and sent it to the king of Assyria. The rabbi said, you did not do the right thing. You should not be taking and appeasing with money that's building the Beit HaMikdash. Chutzpah, you cut off the Beit HaMikdash, send the gold to the king of Ashur. Rashi, shehayol litoch b'hakadosh baruch hu. You should have had bitochan. Sha'ama, because God has said to him, the Ganoisi El Ha'ir Hazat Lahoshi, I will save this city, don't worry. So he should not have bypassed that and sent the gold. Okay, is there a message there for us? I don't know. We don't have the benefit of Nevuah telling us to rely on HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If we did have Nevi'im today, life would be a lot more simple. On the other hand, there's a message coming out of here, which is appeasing and sending gifts to people who at the end of the day want to just invade, is not ultimately going to help a lot. However, the other counterexample, and we'll have to see if any of these really help us today, is Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Look at these sources, very beautiful ideas. Famous number 6, coming up, the Gemara in Gittin, we read this a lot up towards Tisha B'Av, number 6. Amalei Aspianus the Caesar, the Vespasian, the Caesar, who became the Caesar at this point, says to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Remember the story, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was besieged in Yerushalayim. The Birionim, the Zealots, would not let him out because they knew he was going to try and do a deal with the Romans. Eventually he smuggled himself out, pretending that he died. He got to Vespasian and he spoke to him. Boy minai midi da'asan lach. Ask, tell me what I can give you, said Vespasian to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Amalei, he said to him, very famous lines, Heili Yavna v'chachamea, give me the rabbis, the Sanhedrin, we'll move it to Yavna, out of Yerushalayim. V'shulshilta the Rabban and Gamliel, and give me the royal line of David HaMelech, which are the Nesiim of Rabban Gamliel. V'asvasa, the Messiah, Leila Rebbe Tzadik, and give me a doctor of a Rebbe Tzadik. It's interesting what he picked, this very individual case, not getting into that now. Kariyo Rabbi Yosef, later generations said about Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, that moment where he gave away Yerushalayim, and he asked in return for Yavna and the other things, he came to Rabbi Akiva, and some say it was Rabbi Akiva that looked back and criticized Rabbi Akiva, obviously living two generations later. He says, this is the pasuk in Yeshaya, Meshiv Chachamim Achor, that the wise will be turned backwards, V'da'atam Yesakel, and their advice will be foolish. This was foolish, he says, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai to do this. He should have said to Vespasian, L'shavkinu chadazimna, to leave Yerushalayim alone. Save the Mikdash. How could Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai have done something so foolish, says Rabbi Akiva, as to do that? What did Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai think? Dilma kula haylo, other that he wouldn't do that, he wouldn't, if he asked for Yerushalayim, he wouldn't give it to him. And then they wouldn't have anything. Tafasta maruba, lo tafasta. You ask for too much, you end up with nothing. Rashi says, the Isha, Yerushalayim, to leave Yerushalayim, no, I would never. He would never have given him. Interesting. Did Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai do the right thing when he did with the deal with the Romans? Rabbi Akiva thinks he did the wrong thing. He should have held fast. He should have not given in. Look here in number 7, at the end of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's life. Number 7. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai nichnasu talmid of Levakra. When Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai became deathly sick, his talmidim came in to visit him. When he saw them, he started to weep. Amar Eloi Talmidah, the Talmidim said to him, Nei Yisrael, Amud Ayimini, Patisha Chazak, you are the foundation of the Jewish people in so many ways. Why are you crying? Amar Lahim, he said, if they were bringing me in before a human king, Shehayom Kan, Macha Bekever, today he's alive, tomorrow he's dead. Shehim Koyasarayim, even if he's angry, Ein Kas or Kas Oilam, it's only temporary. Ve'im asurani, and even if he locks me up, ein isur isur oilam, it's not forever. Ve'im imsani, and even if he kills me, ein misato misas oilam, that's not forever. Ve'ani yochel afaisa, and I can even appease him, bedvarim u'leshachta b'mammon, and bribe him. Afal pike na'isi bochez, surely I would be crying, even then. Ve'achshav, and now, shemolichim oisi lifnei melech malcheyam lachim ha'kodesh baruch hu. Shehu chai v'kayam la'olam, God is forever. U'le'ol mi'olam in forever and ever. Shim kois alai kois kas oilam. This is, his anger is forever. Ve'im osarani, and if he were to imprison me, asru yisar oilam, this is forever. Ve'im mimisani, and if he kills me, misasu mimas oilam, that's forever. Ve'ani yochel afaisa, I can't appease him, but varim, just by excuses. Ve'lo l'shachta b'mamon, and I cannot bribe him. And here's the key. Ve'lo'od, and not only that. Elashiyesh lefanai shnei drachim. I see, as I'm about to die, two different paths in front of me. Achad shal gan eden, ba'achad shal gehenem. One of gan eden, one of gehenem. Ve'eini yodeh ba'ezem olich masay. And I don't know which way I'm going. Ve'lo'evke. You think I shouldn't cry? Why did he not know which way he was going? So many of the Mephoshim say because for the whole of his life he was traumatized by the question that later Rabbi Akiva would ask, and then no doubt others were already asking, how could you do that? How could you give away Yerushalayim? Maybe it was the right decision, maybe it was the wrong decision. He could never come to terms with that decision. It's an amazing thing. By the way, Rabbi Akiva, who was so critical of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, how could he do something so foolish? His words, foolish. Number 8, look at this Talmud Yerushalmi, in parentheses, Reb Shimon bar Yochai would say, my teacher, Rabbi Akiva, he used to darshan the pasuk, there's a star coming from Yaakov, from the prophecy of Bilam. Rabbi Akiva could have a chami bar kuzba, when he would see Rabbi bar kochba, have a omer, he would say, Dein hu malke mashicha, This is King Messiah. The ultimate nationalist, Rabbi Akiva, said, this is the Mashiach. The Amal Rabbi Yochanan ben Turta, and in his own generation, Rabbi Yochanan ben Turta said to him, Akiva, Yalu asavim belechayayich. There'll be grass growing on your cheeks. The Adayim ben David lo yava, before Mashiach has come. Meaning you'll be long dead and buried before Mashiach is here. You think this is Mashiach? These two ideas, I think, are clearly related. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who was accused by Rabbi Akiva of giving in to the non-Jews, not being strong enough, he himself expressed extreme confidence this man was Mashiach, and he was also wrong. He was also foolish, he doesn't say, but he was wrong. And people of his time said, so, you know, either way, whichever you are, left or right, there are going to be people saying, how could you do this, how could you do that, etc. I'll skip the Sforza for a second. He talks about the idea that if we'd just given in, if the rebels had given in to the Romans, they could have saved the Beis HaMikdash. Look at this very interesting piece from Rav Lichtenstein. This was written around 11 years ago, a sikha that he gave on why did Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai weep. Very poignant, I think, for today, you'll see in a minute. Number 10. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai elects to make a smaller request in order to be certain that his request will be approved. His calculation is realistic, pragmatic, practical, based on facts. He makes his calculation out of uncertainty as to what exactly the Romans will be prepared to allow. This leader of Israel adopts a self-consciously cautious approach. The spiritual future of the Jewish nation is not to be gambled with, and we do not ignore realistic, practical considerations. Sometimes we are even prepared to suffice with saving a little, as long as it is the more certain option. The Gemara presents a dissenting view, but this fact in and of itself testifies to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's approach at the moment of crisis. Faced with the danger of annihilation, he's fully aware of the opposing views, which interpret his decision as weakness and submission. As his life is about to end, he delves into his past to reevaluate his ways and his actions. He is aware of the background to his decision and the considerations that led to it, but fears that perhaps he was mistaken. Perhaps he chose the easier option rather than the more correct one. This doubt breaks down his internal barriers. He bursts into tears of pain and sorrow, repentance and regret. God has placed us in a world of doubt, and the measure of certainty which had allowed him to reach his decision was unavailable to him when he looked back on it. Now look at this next paragraph. Beyond the question of values and the relative weight to be assigned to various considerations, there is the question of the pace of decision-making. On Yom Yerushalayim, this was in May 2010, so he looks back to Yom Yerushalayim that year. On Yom Yerushalayim, we heard an account related in the name of one who was present in the room of a meeting between Prime Minister Netanyahu in his first term and U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. Remember Madeleine Albright? From the Clinton presidency. The Secretary of State strongly admonished the Prime Minister for his plans to build in Yerushalayim. I can't remember where this was. I'm feeling it was Har Gilo. And threatened that United States would remove its support for Israel at the United Nations if Israel did not comply with its demands to cease building. Okay? You ever heard that before? The Secretary of State said that she understood this was a hard decision. She gave the Prime Minister 3 days to respond. The Prime Minister replied that he required no time to consult and to formulate an answer. He refused on the spot to comply with the American demands. Okay. Says Rav Lichtenstein, I mention this episode not because I wish to advocate a specific political approach, but because it touches on key issues of morality and public life, including decision-making processes, consideration of values, halacha, in matters of supreme importance. When a political leader needs to make a decision concerning the entire community, can he risk jumping to a decision just because he may otherwise be considered weak or hesitant? Perhaps he needs to consult, to meditate, to gird himself for 3 days. How can anyone have the audacity to say that a decision of this sort affecting the lives of many people must be taken on the spot? Can all of this be dismissed with a wave of a hand, scorning considerations of the real world and glorifying instant decision making? Obviously, Yerushalayim is a unique place in the world, and the very thought that part of it could be given up causes us to tremble. But a public leader cannot make a decision merely on the basis of trembling. A leader needs to learn from the example of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. He too was dealing with the question of Jerusalem. Unlike some people today, he did not believe that decisions regarding Yerushalayim are to be divorced from all rational considerations. Now, did you think he was going to say that? If you knew Rav Aaron, maybe you did. But, you know, Binyamin Netanyahu, no, I can't even... He's concerned. This, of course, was 25 years ago. You know, today, when we may be, I wouldn't put money on it, but we may be witnessing the end of a 25-year period of Binyamin Netanyahu. I remember Rabbi Kimchi after that election, and it was exactly 25 years ago. It was May the 29th. I looked that up. I didn't remember that. May the 29th, 1996. Rabbi Kimchi, I remember in London, he said a line. He said, Yosef enenu, v'shimon enenu, v'et binyamin tikachu. He said, Yossi Beilin's gone, Shimon Peres is gone, binyamin tikachu, it's time. Okay, fine. I'm not getting political, because that never helps rabbis, ever. But the point is that Rav Lichtenstein said, not so fast, in case you felt like cheering, when Netanyahu said to Albright, forget it. He said, I'm not cheering. He may have made the right decision, but he needs to think about it. Now, let's go on to page 4. Who should decide? This perhaps is the most pressing question. Because we'll see below that when we look at the modern voices and we'll see Rav Avadia Yosef and Rav Cook and Rav Eliezer Melamed and Rav Shach and Lord Jacobovitz and Rav Amital, and we'll see all these people. Constantly in their assessment is the following question. Well, you have to ask the experts. You have to ask the military men. You have to ask the politicians. Well, we have a problem. Because number one, we don't really trust any of these people. We certainly don't trust the politicians. Okay? We don't trust the politicians. That's for sure. I mean, that makes sense, right? But do we trust the military men? Do we not trust the military men? There are also politicians in waiting. Are they making decisions? How do we know who to trust? And they never agree with each other. Always there are going to be a group of people who say, give away Yehuda v'Shamron, it'll be good for us in the long term. And there'll be another group of experts who turn around and say, it'll be suicide in the long run. So what are we meant to do? We the people who have to put our votes in the box. Okay, if we're lucky enough to get a vote on this, sometimes we don't. You know, we never had a vote when Ariel Sharon decided to unilaterally withdraw from Gaza. You know, he was elected on one that he decided to do that. Okay, so sometimes we don't get a vote. But Rabbi Schechter, Rav Herschel Schechter says an interesting thing. He says, what do you do when it's not clear which way to go, and it may be bikuach nefesh in either direction? What do you do? So he brings an example from a sick person. Let's say there's someone who is sick, and there are some doctors that turn around and say, we think you should take this medication, but it may not work, and there may be very bad side effects. So what should he do? He asks some doctors, they say this, some doctors, they say no, stick it out, don't take the medication, you'll be okay, the medication, you know, may not be the right thing to do. What should you do, says the halacha, when there's doctors on one side and doctors on the other side, you get to choose. You don't just go with the majority, because how do you know which way to go? You have to know, your own life depends on it, you make that choice. So too, says Rav Schechter, in a situation where the nation is in potential danger, and some military people say this is the way to go, and some say that is the way to go, and it's not clear which way to go, you have to ask the patient. You have to ask the people. By the way, I put in the notes here, he actually defines the group that gets to choose in a fairly narrow way. He says they have to be one Jewish, two living in Israel, three, they have to be married to Jews, and four, they have to actually be ma'aminim. What exactly that means, ma'aminim, is not clear. Doesn't necessarily mean that means they have to eat mahadrin at the local restaurant, but whatever, you can decide whether you agree with that analysis. But says Rav Schechter, the people have to decide. That's the answer. Make up your mind. I brought you here a response to that. Professor Eliav Shochetman, who I don't know personally, although he's a professor of Mishpat Ivri, and I brought you a little bit in the footnotes as to who he is. He wrote a very good article in Tchumim, which I read through, and he brings a number of arguments against Rav Schechter. And he says, no, you've got the wrong comparison. He says, first of all, we're dealing with Milchemet Mitzvah. We started talking about that last week. In a Milchemet Mitzvah, why are you talking about Pikuach Nefesh? Pikuach Nefesh is completely the wrong thing to be discussing. We pass you like the Minchas Chinuch, and Pikuach Nefesh is not relevant. So the whole thing doesn't get off base one, he says. And secondly, no one can answer these questions. Oh, this group says it'll be better in the long term. This group says this'll be better. No one's a novice. Nobody really knows. So why are you even asking these people? They don't know. You know they don't know. And they know they don't know. And thirdly, he says, you're giving the wrong comparison. Even if you were to compare it to a patient, Bikuach Nefesh, this is not a case where one group of doctors say, try the medication, and the other group say, don't. This is a case where one group of doctors say, try the medication, and the other group say, the medication will kill you. It's a different kind of case. And in that situation, the answer is not ask the patient. The answer is sheva al tase. Do nothing. If you can't work out which is the best thing to do, then preserve the status quo. And he brings many, many examples. He brings a psak of Rav Mordechai Eliyahu. Even in a case, says Rav Eliyahu, when the majority of doctors say take it, the minority of doctors say it'll kill you, then the answer is sheva al tase. Don't do anything. And therefore he says the burden of proof is by a long way on those who advocate in favor of taking the medication, of giving away the territory, and he says, therefore, the answer is Shev Va'al Tase. And he brings an interesting rivash, which I'm not going to go through now, in number 12. He says, since when, if there's a halachic debate, do we ask the people what they think? Really? That's how we resolve this is a halachic shayla. And the rivash has a case there, where a certain rabbi wanted to put somebody in cheirem. And this rabbi was of a stature where he was entitled to put someone in a cheirem. And the people said, are you putting him in a cheirem? No, I'm sorry, rabbi. He's a nice guy. We don't want you to put him in a cheirem. So the rabbi says, the people have no say in that. The people suddenly decide, the rabbi says the meat's not kosher. The people say, no, we think it's kosher. Ain't that back as that? And therefore, you can't go and ask the people. He says, the people in this case are called kesher rasha'im. Even if they're good people. He says they still have a title, Kesher Rasha'im, because they're trying to go against the Rabbanim, and therefore he feels very strongly the decision should not be left to the people. And I don't know whether you feel that democracy is good at making these kind of decisions or not, or whether you feel that the people are the scariest group of all. Okay, could be. Depends on what you hold is the Oilam. People say either the Oilam a Gedolim, or the Oilam is a Goylam. Depending on how you view it, so, you know, you can take your money and pays your money, it takes your choice. Fine. We'll look at now some of these modern voices. Since Rav Shachigman wants us to ask the Rabbonim, let's ask the Rabbonim. Now, obviously, this is a pre-selected group of Rabbonim. You can come back and bring me another 25. But I think this represents a fairly broad range. And therefore I want to bring these to your attention. We won't read all of them, but we'll read many of them. Rav Avadi Yosef wrote many times on this. I brought you a piece from 1980 in Torah Sheba'al Peh in the journal. I brought you a piece from 1989 in Tchumen. And then I brought you a piece from 2003. Let's have a look at number 13 first. Ulam im Rashi u'mifkedei hatzava, in the heads and the officers of the army say, Yachad im chevrei hamenshala, together with the government, if they come to the view, Yikvu sheyesh bikuach nefesh v'davar, that there is a danger to Jewish life hanging on to this territory, שאם לא יוחסרו שטחים מארץ ישראל, קיימת סכנה מלחמה מיידית מצד השכנים הערבים, that if they come to the view that giving away this land will avoid bloodshed, וכזה וכזה תלך על החרב, חס ושלום, and if there's a war, God forbid, people will get killed on every side, ואם יוחסרו להם השטחים, and if you give away this land, תורחק מעליהם סכנת המלחמה, then the war will be, the chances of war will be averted, and there may even be a long-lasting peace. He thinks according to everybody. Now, I don't know. According to all, I don't think it's according to all the deos. Maybe according to all the classic sources he feels, it's permitted to give away the land. He's taken a clear stand on the debate. Not like the Milchas Chinuch. The Milchas Chinuch said, forget about Pikuach Nefesh. This is a war, guys. He says, no, this Pikuach Nefesh is relevant here. He said a similar thing in 89. He said, number 14, Arumi kol amor, if it becomes evidently clear, well, that may already exclude any kind of case we're in, she'yir shalom emet, there'll be a real peace, beinenu levein shcheinenu, and between us and the shenenu ha'aravim, the Arab nations, im yuchzru lehem ha'shtachim, ulum azot kayemet sakana milchama miyadit, and there's an immediate concern of war, im lo yuchzru lehem ha'shtachim, yesh lachzir lehem ha'shtachim, mishum she'en lecha davar amot bikuach nefesh. He kept his position through the 80s. Ulechein tzarech ladun v'davar b'choyvid rosh, karoi, you have to think very carefully about this, ula'ach chavadat, you have to have a meeting of experts, muskemi b'mitzkedei ha'sava, u'mediyim, ha'mulchim b'inyanei b'tachon, u'katorah ya'asko, and you have to do what the Torah wants you to do in this area. Now, they went back to Rav Avadia in the 2000s, when Oslo had come, this was all pre-Oslo, right? When Oslo unraveled in the 2000s, which many of us remember, all of us I'm sure remember, they went to Rav Avadia and they said to him, no, you still think the same thing, or do you not think the same thing? Have you changed your mind? And he said in number 15, he said, of course I haven't changed my mind, but what we see now is clearly my criteria for giving away land are clearly not met. Says Rav Avad number 15, but Ratzoni Lahav here, I want to clarify et emdati b'inyan yesha in Yehuda Shomron v'Aza. Lo pam hisbarti mikfar ki psak alacha ashen atati. I've said to you many, many times that the psak I gave is manu when in its appropriate time, shtachim tmurat shalom, of land for peace, Eino tokef klal leregel hamatzav hanukhi. It is not relevant at all to what we find ourselves in today. Ani hitkavanti, I was intending ach v'rak l'shalom emet, to a real peace. Oh, Yerushalayim mitzvotei yishkenu levetach, Jerusalem could live in peace. V'shalom v'shalva, in peace, and sheket, etc. Ulam ata, now what do we have? Eineinu royes v'chalos ki adarava. Mesirat shtachim, we see now that giving away this land, may I say from our land, a kedosha, goremet l'sakanat nefoshot. It's causing loss of life. Lo l'shalom kezei yichalnu. This is not the piece that I talked about. The lo l'nar azed palalnu. He's quoting Chana here. The fikach has heskem oslo bachel uvutal. Oslo is finished, he says. I'm not interested in Oslo. Ki ani shalom v'ki adaber heima l'milchama. Okay, and I am for peace and they are for war. To posit from Tehillim in Kafchaf. Ve'ein lanu al mi lishan ela al avinu sheba shamayim. Certainly not on the politicians. Okay, so Rav Avadia said, in principle, I agree with giving away land for peace, but the peace has to be a real peace, without any question, and it can't be something that's going to just lead us down a road to more and more fighting. That may, as far as you're concerned, answer the whole position in terms of Rav Avadia, but he was very clear. Rav Shechter, interestingly, in his article in the Journal of Halacha, he comes to a fascinating conclusion. He says, Chazal told us that the Geula would come through war. We looked at these sources back towards Yom HaTzmaut. And therefore, if we're in a war now, in Eretz Yisrael, and you stop the war, you're impeding the Geula. Remarkable. If you'd have asked me, who would say that? Give me a list of rabbis that would say that. I would not have guessed, Rav Shechter. You can look at the article. He says, we're in a war, it's a war we're meant to be in, if you stop the war, you'll end the Geula. Okay? Interesting. Very interesting. Rav Moshe Tzuriel, who is the Mashkiach, or was at least, in Yeshiva Chalvim, he quotes from Tzvi Yehuda, and he says it's totally prohibited to give anything away. And we'll look now at that view for a couple of minutes. Have a look at Rav Moshe Tzuriel number 16. I could have brought many people. I brought him because I think he puts it very clearly in a short paragraph. Isa Mesirat Shtach Eretz Yisrael Yidei HaGoyim. Kol Zot V'Din HaTzibur. In terms of the public, then there's a prohibition, he says, to give land away. Everything that's ever been said about giving away land to save life, he makes a very important point. That whole discussion, he says, about pikuach nefesh, he says that's on an individual level. You want to buy a house in Israel. Someone sticks a gun to your head and says, don't buy this house. Don't buy the house. Go back to Monty. Go back to Monty. You don't have to die in order to buy a house in Yerushalayim. So that's what we're talking about. So that the Jewish people as a whole should give away. Even one inch of Israel is Israel. To a non-Jewish rulership, forget about the Ramban. Of course it's also according to the Ramban. You're not possessing the land. And it's absolutely clear that we don't question, it's not an issue of pikuach nefesh, because pikuach nefesh is irrelevant. They're not only prohibited of doing that prohibition, but they're also breaking other isurim. That they're causing other Jews to lose hope. People will become less convinced that they can win if you start giving away concessions. Do not be afraid. There's a mitzvah in Pasha Shoftim. Don't be afraid of the non-Jews when they come to take Eretz Israel or try to. If someone is afraid, he's allowed limdod l'chutz la'aretz to go and emigrate. Okay, if you're scared individually, you can go to chutz la'aretz. But God forbid to give away Eretz Israel on a klali level. Because on this, interesting perspective. Everyone who discussed this idea of pikuach nefesh was only ever thinking about the individual, never thinking about the klal. And therefore he says, I can tell you something else. As far as I'm concerned, this is a war not just on the Jewish people in Israel, but on Judaism. This is about Jews, not about Zionists. And I think that that's pretty clear. And that's the point that has to be made. One of my students posted something pro-Israel on Facebook or whatever it was, and she got a response from an Arab work colleague of hers. He says, why are you always posting about Jews? We love Jews. We just don't like Zionists. We don't like Israel, but we love Jews. So she wrote to me and she said, what shall I respond to her? So I sent her a clip from a rally in Belgium where everyone's there waving the Palestinian flags and shouting, it's Bachal Yehud. Said, this is not about Jews. This is not about Israel. They're not shouting down with Israel. They're talking about Jews. So he says, this is about Judaism. And therefore it becomes, and I think this is a very interesting point, Yahari Va'al Yavor, it becomes something not just about a halachic question, should I, shouldn't I, but it becomes a question of one has to give up one's life for a Judaism under threat. Afilo al arkasad amasam, even on the how you tie your shoelaces, famous line, when it comes to they're trying to defeat Judaism, then even on the smallest of matters, which were never officially Yahari Va'al Yavor, they become Yahari Va'al Yavor. The king comes over Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook. We'll get to Rav Kook in a minute, but no one says that. The Cholof and Divrei HaRambam, actually you can read the rest on your own, that he feels it's absolutely prohibited. It's Yahari Va'al Yavor, and he's giving a rationale for that, which I think is definitely something that needs considering. Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, I brought you two pieces in translation in 17 and 18. He says, we have absolutely no right to relinquish control over any piece of Eretz Israel. We cannot do this because we are not the only owners of the land. Each of these pieces, I think, brings a new consideration. We are the emissaries of millions of Jews, not only the Jews of today, but the Jews who will come after us as well. A short while ago, an important Zionist activist told me that an old Russian woman approached him in Vienna and told him, hold on to all parts of Eretz Israel for us. This was before the Russian Aliyah. Rav Tzvi Yehuda died long before the Russians came in great numbers. Hold on to Eretz Israel for us. Don't relinquish Amita. Soon we will be coming. And indeed they did. There isn't any man who is permitted to make territorial concessions on this land. Are these kilometers ours? Is someone the owner of them? These kilometers belong to the millions of Jews in Russia and America throughout the world, no less than they belong to us. We are here as the representatives of the nation of Israel. We are not its owners without them. How can a person not feel ashamed by the thought of making do with a truncated state? No one has the right to relinquish lands which belong to the millions of Jews of all generations. It is a disgrace, a shame, violation of the Torah, etc., etc. And he brings also number 18, there must be no retreat from a single kilometer, etc., etc. So I think that this is a very important point of view. And if you look, this is explicated in some detail, which I'm not going to read through in detail now, but Rav Eliezer Melamed, current contemporary posek in Har Bracha and more widely in Israel and now much more in the world as well. Now they've translated many of his Panini Halachas for him into English. They're actually being very successfully received in America. He lists seven different reasons why it is prohibited to give any part of Eretz Israel away. And he talks about Mitzvah Yishuv Haaretz, he talks about the Ramban, Minchas Chinuch that we talked about. He talks about the idea of Sakonas Nefoshes, which will work against us giving away land. And then he brings in some other considerations we haven't thought about. In Gimel, he says there's a posik in Shmot. Lo yishavu ba'artecha. Lo yishavu ba'artecha, excuse me. You may not allow them to live in your land. That's another issue. Lo yishachanem, we talked about last week. You may not give a chanaya, the karka, to the non-Jewish world. Lo timka litzmitut. Lo timaker litzmitut, excuse me. The land may not be sold permanently. And he talks about the gezela. Even the melech doesn't have the right to take away the house of a Jew and give it to a non-Jew outside Eretz Israel. He says all of these things of Chilul Hashem as well. I leave you to read that in some detail. He goes through it and he cross-references there all of the other places that he talks about this. One could really, read this through and spend months and months just analyzing his arguments, but he comes out very clearly that it is absolutely prohibited. Now, over the next page, number 8. The Lubavitch, Lubavitcher Rebbe. Oh, we haven't seen the Lubavitcher Rebbe. The Lubavitcher Rebbe was completely consistent throughout the last 50 years that he said one may not give an inch of Eretz Israel away. Look at his argument. Number 22. This is in 1968, just after the Six-Day War. There is absolutely no benefit or advantage to be gained from giving away land, since their word is worthless. As we've seen in the past, all the assurances of peace, Rashi says, it's halacha, Esav hates Yaakov. He says, you're living in a dream world if you think everybody loves us. And the sages have spoken extensively on all the ways in which kindness of the nations is really veiled sin. It is clear that Israel has nothing to gain from giving away land, as we've seen in the past, even the recent past in the episode 12 years ago in the Suez Canal. That was the Suez Crisis. Especially during the past year, every time talk of surrendering territory is made known, there is a new wave of terrorism. Increasing death and destruction, as we can clearly see. And then he talks about, in 23 as well, there's secret bargaining going on to give away land. In 24. All the pressure, concessions and so on are founded in and encouraged by well-known Jewish influential groups within Israel, whose influence on international relations is at times absolute. Moreover, they actually invite pressure, either directly or indirectly. An undeniable proof to this, one I've already pointed out many times, has even been publicized in the papers, is the fact that immediately after the Six-Day War, they sent an official, though inconspicuous, delegation made of government representatives to Washington with an offer to give back all the territories, etc. And he talks about the fact that as far as he's concerned, peace is just, not land for peace, but land into pieces. And he says it'll never go anywhere. History is constantly coming round in circles. A large number of American Jewish academics who wrote over the last week or two very strongly in favor of Hamas, against the Israeli position on that. There's nothing new in the world. However, let's go on to look at Rav Shach, because we need to balance a little bit. Yeah? We need to give a little bit of the other side of the coin. Rav Shach constantly said whatever he felt, and he wasn't trying to earn any friends, and he wasn't afraid of making enemies, but he wrote in 1978 when the Camp David Accords were being discussed. Yeah? Should Israel give away Sinai to Egypt for a long-lasting peace treaty? And look at Rav Shach's Cheshbonot here. Number 27. Ulam. B'inyan mashikat of pilpul hilchati, v'davach achzar shtachim. There's a halachic debate going on right now, giving away land in Eretz Israel. She'achshav hen tachat shilton Yisrael, currently ruled sovereignty under Israel, umafalto de inya pikuach nefesh, and there's a question about pikuach nefesh. Ladati, in my opinion, hanachah zot shezen nogei lepikuach nefesh, ein ze baro klal uklal. It's not at all clear which way the pikuach nefesh argument goes. It's really not, he says. V'yesh harbe be'anshi atzava, there are many army people, shedatam hil behepach, that are against the idea of keeping the land. Meaning, he said, people are saying, if you give away Sinai, it'll endanger Israel. He says, well, I can find you many army people will say that the opposite. If you give away Sinai, it'll benefit Israel. The peace that we'll get by giving away land, it'll remove, it'll reduce greatly the amount of bloodshed. Well, without the aim of that social sophic, I don't think there's any question on the halakhic level, he says. If there's a peace treaty, then we can expect that it will reduce bloodshed. And he brings a point we haven't talked about today. It's not just about us, says Rav Shach, about in Israel. There is Israel. It's about the Jews around the world. If there is no peace in the Middle East, that affects everything in the world. An amazing thing. Incredible thing. I mean, it seems almost to me supernatural how we can have just been through what we went through and then people are blaming Israel for what goes on. Almost beyond understanding. Shema Matzav, the powers of the world, Haggadah, the great superpowers, they all get involved in this. Israel is always important. No one really cares that much what happens in Burma or in here or in there. Israel is very, very central to people. The people want to make these different sides on this. One superpower will take these countries, because this was still in the Cold War. And another superpower, and another will start another camp. And there'll be an arms race. And then there'll be a war which is even worse than the one you were trying to avoid. What will happen to us then? What will it help us if, God forbid, there's a world conflagration on this? Oh, don't worry, because we held on to another hill. What good is the hill? tikufatenu, shichlal klei neshek, in our times when there's a shichlul, constant upgrading of awful weapons of mass destruction, higia lesia shichlul, she'ashel achriv yarot medinot shleimot merechot, they can destroy land from with missiles from thousands of miles away. Mashach b'zeh she'ein levater, v'asur levater. Why are we still screaming, you can't give up anything? Amashi Yerusha hi lanu me'avoteinu, what we got from our fathers. V'chibanu hadavar talui, is it dependent on us, v'yadeinu huzeh? Halogam achshav, v'lo siyu shal artas abrid, if we didn't have the help of America, afilu chadesh, echad, even 1 month. Pachod mezi, even less than a month. Ein lanu mishilenu klum, kidei lehitkayem. We wouldn't be able to survive for a minute. That's a good question. Yesterday, Netanyahu, I heard him on the radio. If we have to choose between America and between saving ourselves, we will always choose to save ourselves rather than America. Okay, so Rav Shach, are you confident enough to say that? V'chol elu shemadabrin gvor gvor, all the people who shout higher, higher, anachnu, anachnu, anachnu ninateach. Himrak bin beinai dalgal, they're all arrogant and foolish. It's just not true. Shachodesh baruch hu sonei ato. This is the way to be? Interesting. Now Rav Shach, Rashach was never shy to say, how do you know that this is, there'll never be another Khorban? There'll never be another Khorban. But how do you know? You don't know. This piece explains that very clearly, in which case we have to be looking with eyes that are very practical at the world situation, etc. Now again, Rashach is no longer alive. I don't know what he would say today at the situation, but clearly his arguments were at the time very, very important. Lord Jacobovitz makes an interesting distinction. You can read this yourself. He talks about Pikuach Nefesh, and that giving away land in Eretz Israel is required in order to save life. But then at the end he says, look at 28, in an altogether unique category is Yerushalayim. It enjoys the sanctity of its own and the common possession of all Jews wherever they may live, the gateway of their prayers, the symbol of their hopes. Now happily also the spiritual heart of Jewish learning. To save life, he says, one can amputate a limb or even excise parts of an internal organ, but not the heart. Interesting. Now he drew a line at Yerushalayim. Interesting. That was his line. Because that's the heart of the Jewish people. I brought you a quote from the Rambam earlier that I didn't read about amputation. He compares, if you need to save the life of a patient by amputating an arm or a leg, you do that so too. If you need to save Judaism by amputating a mitzvah, then the rabbis have the right to do that. Okay, the Sanhedrin, that's not us. But Lord Jacobovitz draws that line. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, I brought you his letter that he wrote to Rav Shapira, who was the Rosh Hashiva at the time in Merkaz Arab, before the disengagement in 2005, where Rav Shapira said it's completely prohibited. And Rav Lichtenstein said there are other considerations we have to think more broadly. And I brought you here, he compares the issue of Shemitah. You're prepared to sell the land for Shemitah to a non-Jew, but not for this. But of course, there's a very big difference, because for Shemitah, you sell the land in order to build the Yishuv, rather than to risk the Yishuv. Whatever, you can read the letter of Rav Lichtenstein. Again, I have no idea what Rav Lichtenstein would say today. What Rav Aaron Lichtenstein would say today, with the benefit of the hindsight of the last 20 to 15 years, I know what Rav Moshe Lichtenstein says today, and it's not so far away from what his father said 20 years ago, as he talks about going on to Temple Mount. He says, I'm not sure if there is a mitzvah to go on to Temple Mount, but there's for sure a mitzvah not to ignite the whole Middle East in war. Okay, different perspectives on that as well, you can hear from Rav Moshe. Rav Amital brought here a beautiful idea. Rav Amital brings a midrashic and halachic analysis where he says there is a pecking order. You can read this in your own time, where he says what is more important than what? You have Am Yisrael, you have Torah Yisrael, and you have Eretz Yisrael. And he brings sources to show that the order of priority is number one, Am Yisrael, number two, Torah Yisrael, and number three, Eretz Yisrael. And therefore we have to be prepared to sacrifice the ones lower where necessary in order to preserve the ones higher. And he builds that, he brings that very clearly, and he brings also from Rav Kook. Rav Amital obviously had a lot to say on this issue, and he was very much in favor of a thought-through analysis, like Rav Lichtenstein said, not just an impromptu decision. Page 11, I brought you Rabbi Bleich, who we looked at pretty much last week. By the way, Rav Aaron says very clearly, even if you decide not to follow Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook's position on giving away territory for peace, you have to follow his position on how painful it is to disconnect from Eretz Yisrael. He says, you can't think of it as, oh, okay, fine, stay there. No, it should make a person tremble with all the idea that you're even discussing these matters. But anyway, so he talks about that before. I brought you at the very end something which I think we need to look at in another share, but not next week. I'm ready for Gairos now. He talked about, I brought you some sources about whether soldiers should disobey orders in order to carry out either the dismantling of land in Yehuda v'Shomron or the other side, the protection of people in Yehuda v'Shomron. And of course, you hear from both sides of the spectrum on the army that they refuse orders or question to refuse orders to either protect or to dismantle. And I brought you a little bit at the end which you can look at as to everyone agrees, and this is something we need to think about more in more detail, everyone agrees that a truly illegal order, military order, has to be disobeyed. Everybody agrees with that. The question is how you define an illegal order. Your own political opinions don't define it as illegal, okay? And even the fact that it might be technically illegal, let's say a commanding officer says, go get supplies from that store over there, even though they only have permission from that. So that you have to follow an order, because that's only technically illegal. Whereas an obviously illegal order, and I put some definitions here, there was the whole Kfar Qasim trial, where there was a killing of unarmed combatants and how that worked. But we can talk about that more in another piece, because I think that's an important topic in and of itself. As I brought you at the very end, number 13, if you want to do a bit of pre-reading, page 13 rather, a tshuva of Rav Yehuda, Yadid, who wrote a tshuva here about the issue of refusing military orders and whether you can, whether you can't, etc. But we'll save that for another day. Okay, what is our conclusion? Look, I think that everybody who argued in any way or direction at all, there is only even a half a minute, there's only the beginning of a suggestion if there's a legitimate reality that whatever you're planning to do could save life. The question that we're going to have to deal with, and as this becomes again a question on the agenda, is who decides, how do we decide, and what do we do about that? Because unfortunately, well maybe fortunately, we're not the ones who are making those decisions. I wouldn't want to make the decisions, but we ultimately are the people who have to live with them. So maybe the best way to conclude is with a tefillah, that whatever our leaders are doing, thinking and saying, HaKadosh Baruch Hu should give them the insight to decide in a way which is for the long term to Eretz and Klal Yisrael, for Teres Yisrael and for Eretz Yisrael, and we just have to do the very best we can. But like Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, it's very hard to know what the right decisions are, even in a situation like this. Okay, let's leave this for now. Next week we go on to Parshas New. Be'ezrat Hashem.